Welcome to the Voices of Windrush with me, Sinai Flary, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Patrick Vernon. Good morning.
Good morning to you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. We've got some special guests in the studio
this morning. Certainly has. Obviously, this is the first show that we're going to be doing looking at Windrush. So I've got Jacqueline McKenzie, or Jackie, who's an immigration lawyer based in Streatham. She's been played a key role around the whole Windrush scandal in advising, supporting the Windrush generation. And I've got Martin Ford QC, who was appointed by the government last year, and he's been helping to devise the Windrush compensation scheme.
So good morning, Jackie, and good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us this morning. The last 12 months have been shocking, hurtful, very interesting for a lot of people in our community surrounding the Windrush scandal. Just from my point of view, being a child of Caribbean migrants who came to this country, I've followed the Windrush scandal very closely, and I feel very upset about what's happening, and I'm hoping that you guys will be able to provide much information that people need, and reassurance as well, and some help and tips and advice. Firstly, Jacqueline, there's some people still out there who haven't secured their status, who haven't sorted out their British citizenship as of yet. What sort of advice would you give them, and where could they go for help?
Well, there are two sets of people, really. So there are those who haven't come forward, you know, and you find them all over the place. I recently found some in a local betting shop because they're still very suspicious of the Home Office, very suspicious of the government. They think it's too good to be true. You know, they believe that there might still be some enforcement issues. They might be detained, removed, or deported. So that's a big issue. It's really trying to encourage people to come forward. And I would say to anybody who's been in the country since before 1988, there aren't going to be any issues. They really should come forward. Mm-hmm. The second issue are a group of people who have actually made applications to the Home Office and theirs hasn't been processed yet. And we're quite concerned about that. I mean, I know of a case of someone who's been waiting 12 months for a decision from the task force. I mean, we're regularly seeing cases of people who've been waiting for more than 6 months. A lot of those are people with criminal convictions, albeit, but our view is if they're British, they're British, and so there should be no issue, certainly about them being recognised as settled in the country. British citizenship is something else, of course. So the message really is to the Home Office to get on with it. You know, initially you promised under your sort of key indicator performance targets that people would be assessed within 2 weeks, and we're seeing that that's not the case at all. So that's really an issue. In terms of where people can go for help, there's lots and lots of places. I suppose I'm not really entitled to promote my own firm, but Mackenzie Bertram Pope, I must say, has been working pro bono up until now for people who need assistance with completing their application forms. That's for status documents. You know, there's also the organisation Windrush Action, and a lot of the members of Windrush Action are people who are actually directly affected by the scandal, and some of them have become advocates actually and have been helping each other or helping people who are non-members. But there are lots of organisations around the country who are helping, and perhaps just a Google search will reveal some of them.
Brilliant. Okay. Patrick, I know you're a Windrush campaigner and have been for some time, and you're also a social commentator. What's your take on the whole scandal? Was you aware that there was something huge like this to come before the story broke in the media last year?
I mean, to be quite honest, I think up to that point, I think everyone thought there were isolated individual cases. It's only when I actually got involved directly. I mean, I've always been promoting the whole historiography of Windrush generation and the legacy. But I think when I got involved in one particular case, Waldo Romeo, who is now chair of Windrush Action, and I met him and he told me his situation, I realised that this was targeting the Caribbean community and the African community. And then I launched my petition, and I worked with JCWI and Run Me Trust. I got to know Jacqueline through that process and other activists and campaigners. And obviously, there was pressure on the government. And I think the Caribbean High Commissioner has played a role. And there's no coincidence we can explore that when the Caribbean heads met about a year ago, which was hosted by the British government, and the Caribbean governments wanted to meet Theresa May, and she refused that, and that further accelerated matters. So I think we can spend the whole time talking about the history of it, but I think the key thing is action. What needs to be done now? Obviously, as Jackie said, people still need to sort out the status. We're going to hear from Martin shortly about a compensation scheme. I'm from a historical perspective, legacy perspective, I'm concerned about the historiography and the documentation of the Windrush story, because I think one of the reasons why we had the scandal in the first place was because people don't know why we came, yeah. What we did, how we contributed, and the impact of our legacy. And people still don't know that. I mean, yes, I've been involved in the campaign around Windrush and National Windrush Day, but we need a hell of a lot more work to do. And also within the community, not many people in the community, even like different generations, didn't know about why their grandparents came and what they did and the parents came. So we've got a lot of stuff to do in the community to teach ourselves. To otherwise, we'll have another scandal. It might be Windrush 2.0 or 3.0 with a different dimension to that. And why is it that it's always us? Why is it always the black community? We seem to be at the sharp end of the law, the criminal justice system. You know, it's almost like an example of racial profiling again.
Mm.
We've been racial profiled in terms of stop and search. We're racially profiled in the boardroom, and now we're racially profiled around our own citizenship and status. So I think there's like kind of key issues as well.
Yeah. I mean, I know we interviewed Sadiq Khan a few months ago, and he said that the Windrush scandal was a stain on the nation's conscience. Yeah. Is that something that you would agree with?
I think most people would agree. I mean, what's quite clear with the Windrush scandal, that yes, even though at the heart of it, it's been people of Caribbean heritage has been affected by that, but a lot of people up and down the country have been quite disgusted by the way the government has treated the Windrush generation and the wider issues around migration. And when people signed, for example, my petition, nearly about 180,000, if you looked at the heat map, which you can still see on the government website, people from Shetland Islands all the way down to Isle of Wight signed that petition. So a lot of people up and down the country felt that this class of people are British and they were treated in a very shoddy way. So I think we had that sympathy, but we have to bear in mind that the only reason why we got that sympathy because we were seen as good migrants.
Yeah.
Not you know, and that's the issue in itself.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's so much to unpack surrounding this. I want to bring in Martin Ford, QC, so you can tell us a bit more about the Windrush compensation scheme.
Yeah, and I mean, I think before I do, I should explain my involvement. I work as a barrister in independent practice. I don't work for the Home Office. I got an indication from a senior judge that they might be looking for somebody to help design a compensation scheme. And it's ironic because I was just about to write a letter, it may not have been published, to one of the major broadsheets protesting about the treatment, which might have disqualified me from doing the job. But I did feel very strongly that a generation who suffered enormous problems and discrimination were finding themselves singled out yet again. I mean, my parents came in the 50s and they came as invitees. They thought they were coming to the mother country. That's how it was sold to them. And they had a very difficult experience when they arrived. I mean, many of their generation wanted to go back within a week or two, but couldn't afford to do so. And I was very lucky. I went back in the 70s. With my family, which was an expensive trip for my parents, and my dad had effectively saved up for 22 years to get back, hadn't seen his parents for that length of time. And that was again an eye-opener for me to go and spend some time in a black nation as against where I was born and brought up. So it was all very close to my heart. I was also, as Patrick's mentioned, very impressed by the fact that there was universal condemnation in terms of the government action. And it's very rare to see the right-wing press and the left-wing press united on an issue.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of goodwill around the Windrush scandal. It does affect more people than those from the Caribbean. I mean, anybody who's had their immigration status questioned, it seems to me, ought to be considering themselves a victim of Windrush until proven otherwise. So I know Jackie had a client who came here aged four from America, and she has qualified, And again, I would emphasise the need for people to sort out their status. There are still people I meet who think because they were born overseas at a time before their islands got independence, they were born under a British flag, therefore they are British. They need to get naturalised status still, and certainly that pre-1973 cohort. So the idea of the scheme was to try and devise something which would compensate people for the wrongs that they suffered. And it's very complicated. I accept that what happened was we sent out a document calling for evidence. I went around the country, Jackie and I did various roadshows, and we got people's stories, and we were able to identify certain areas where people had suffered. So some had lost their jobs, some had been denied access to benefits, some had been denied access to the NHS, some had been rendered homeless because they lost their jobs. Obviously, the most serious cases were cases where people had been detained and deported. Mm. And we looked at about 13 different areas and tried to come up with a way of compensating in those areas. I impressed upon the Home Office two things. One, the closeness of the families. So quite often if there'd be an intergenerational dependency, so you might only be able to work because your parents were doing your childcare. So obviously if the grandparents' status is questioned, they go underground, they don't want to work. For the children, then the children can't work, then the grandchildren suffer. So it's an intergenerational thing as well. So there is a way of family members bringing claims for the impact upon their lives of seeing another family member suffer. And then the final area, which really struck me because of the tragic death of Sarah O'Connor last September, and Patrick, I know, was very involved in that, in fact, crowdfunded for her funeral. It struck me that her daughters, insofar as their mother had a claim, that claim should survive for her daughters. So you can inherit claims where, unfortunately, people have tragically passed away, both here and overseas.
Okay.
So my concerns now, I think, are implementation. So I need people like Jackie to tell me how it actually works on the ground. And I've always been concerned about overseas reach. I got a meeting on Tuesday with the Home Office, and I impress upon them again my concerns that there may well be people overseas that have a right to live here, and there may be people who have no idea that they can claim compensation.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, I've had some people contact me and ask me about the compensation scheme. Is it real? Is it not real? Is it just a hoax? And I'm like, no, it's real. How come you don't know about it? A lot of people just haven't had the information reach them, which is very, very unfortunate. And like you said, people who have been deported back to the Caribbean, it makes you question, you know, if some people here haven't got the information, then what hope is there for people who are miles and miles and miles away?
Well, that's why I think programs like this are so important.
Yeah.
To get the message out there. I've been quite keen for some sort of national campaign.
Totally.
In the same way as you've seen that for EC nationals. So you can stand by a bus shelter and see that it's a settlement scheme. There are public service broadcasts. On radio stations. I think I was listening to a radio station driving back from my father's, and in between songs there was information about EC settlement, and it seems to me that's something that needs to be considered, proper communications budget to publicise this.
Yeah. And for people who want to put in a claim for compensation, where do they go?
Well, this is interesting. I know Jackie's got some views. The way it is supposed to work is that you can download a form from a government website.
Okay.
You can call a helpline. If you think you need assistance with the form, they communicate with Citizens Advice, who will make you an appointment to either have a telephone consultation with them or a face-to-face meeting. And I am assured that there will be people at Citizens Advice who are trained in the form guidance and walking people through the form. Now, I'm aware, through my discussions with Jackie, that some people had unfortunate experiences with Citizens Advice around immigration status. And it, again, it's another issue, isn't it? There's a huge breakdown in trust, I'm afraid, between big government and the communities affected. And the proof of the pudding will be in the eating. Ideally, I think that it would have been... the most foolproof scheme would have allowed people to apply for legal aid to fill in these forms with proper legal assistance. That was something I asked about in terms of the design of the scheme. I was told it would need a change in legislation and could delay things for months, if not years. And as you can imagine, not much is going through on the statute book with Brexit.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate. And it may well be that, you know, people should continue to agitate for that. But there are community groups springing up who are going to be running clinics, churches, community organisations. I'm trying to get around them to explain how I think the scheme should work and how to maximise claims. But we do need, I think, trusted community organisations with good governance. And I am told the government is going to put out for tender contracts, which I think may have to be regional rather than national, for those trusted groups to assist with making claims. So I think my advice, and there have been claims, I think something like 1,400 forms have been downloaded already. I think there have been 5 people who've contacted the scheme from overseas. There are some fee refund claims, which I'm told will be processed within a matter of weeks, so people will start to see money coming through. I think that possibly it needs to settle down a little. At the moment, you know, we're getting constructive feedback from people saying there are aspects that may or may not have been covered, and that enables me to go back to the Home Office and say, we forgot about this, we didn't think about that. And thus far, they've been fairly responsive to tweaking things, because you can't predict every type of claim. So I would have thought, give it 2 or 3 months to settle down, and then there'll be a debate about how long the scheme's open for, which is another issue as to whether there's supposed to be a 2-year window. And I'm already thinking that the way things have gone, that probably ought to be extended from the time that the community organisations come on stream, because they will have more of a response because they are more trusted by the community. So I'd like to see those organisations get up and running and see how that plays out.
Yeah. I mean, Jackie, Patrick, I mean, do you have anything to add to what Martin's just said there about the compensation scheme?
Well, I've been quite critical of elements of it. I mean, I certainly accept that, you know, until people have applied and we see what happens, but, you know, we've made quite a lot of some of the things that we thought were quite insulting, like low tariffs, you know, people reclaiming legal fees that they've spent of £500 and lack of ability to go to university at £500. And you know, we've been quite shocked about that. But I think some of us have come to a recognition that we're just going to get people to put in for what they want to put in and see what happens, and then possibly go to court if they don't get it. We're almost going to ignore those tariffs. We're very concerned about how people with certain types of criminal convictions, or rather criminal sentences, might be treated. Hopefully there might be some movement on that. But I think overall, though, my main concern is what the scheme doesn't cover. And I think Martin's absolutely right in saying that, you know, you can't cover every eventuality. But I think that the scheme, I mean, it took 12 months. And it, to me, demonstrates how little respect the government has for our community, in that it had so much consultation. I saw Martin going around the country doing consultation. Some of us put in quite elaborate commentary as submissions. You know, Windrush Action actually had two leading teams, from Doughty Street Chambers and Birnberg Pierce Solicitors, which have done quite a lot of work on schemes, put in quite substantive submissions. And it seems to me that perhaps those submissions, I won't say they've been ignored in their entirety, but I don't think that they've been really reflective, because some of the issues that we're now discussing are in those submissions. I have a feeling also that the way the government has unrolled, or if that's such a word, you know, the scheme, shows that it really doesn't care. about the black community. I don't know whether an equality impact assessment was conducted at all on the nature of, you know, we look at the cohort, we know that the Windrush, because there's two separate things when we talk about the Windrush generation and we talk about the Windrush scandal. We know that the government has opened it up to, I mean, although it calls it a Commonwealth scheme, it isn't a Commonwealth scheme. It's open to absolutely anybody from any country that's come in from before 1988. However, in terms of the scandal, if you look at the data that's been presented to National Audit Office or, you know, the Home Affairs Select Committee, who has been predominantly affected by the scandal has been Caribbean people. And you can even break down that cohort even further. It's elderly Jamaicans in the main, not exclusively, but in the main. That's more than 75% of the cohort. And I've seen over 500 of them through surgeries that I was doing. And a lot of them, there's all sorts of issues. There's literacy, there's health, there's poverty, there's mental health. And to just ignore the community in this, you know, to say, well, we're going to give it to Citizens Advice Bureau, which receives 80% of their funding from government, which most people, I mean, a Citizens Advice Bureau around the corner from my office, and each morning when I'm parking, the queues are down the door and down the road. And elderly Caribbean people have their dignity. You know, when they come to my office and they say, well, I haven't got any money, and before I end up taking on their case for no money, I said, well, do you know there's CAB around the corner?
Yeah.
And they said, well, we're not going there.
Yeah.
We're not going there. We've already been there and we have to stand up in the road, everybody's seeing us.
So there's already cultural barriers.
So there's an issue. There's an issue. And there is also the issue that I've been dealing with a number of people who went there at the start, when they first encountered hostile environment issues around immigration. Now, most bits of the Citizens Advice Bureau don't do immigration, but some bits do. The one in Streatham, where I am, does. It has immigration office, staff, caseworkers in there, and they weren't able to help people. So that's the same organisation that you're sending people back to. But there's also another problem, because what's happening is you fill out your form, you go to the Citizens Advice Bureau, they're checking, they're fact-checking. Okay, so you say you lost your job. Have you got evidence that you had a job? That's not the job to be done. The job to be done is that you've got to sit with people. And I've worked on redress schemes in the past. One of the redress schemes I did a lot of work on was, you know, redress for victims of the Catholic Church, Irish victims of the Catholic Church and Magdalene Holmes. And what you've got to do, the approach is, you've got to sit with people for hours.
Yeah.
And get their story. Because the boxes, and where Martin is correct about, you know, those of us who've been quite critical of the tariffs and you can shift into other columns, he's absolutely right. But to do that, you've really got to get out of people. How has your life been affected by this? It might not be that you've lost a job and you've got a letter from your previous employer, but it might be the stress of you and your daughter for 12 years walking around the country saying to everybody, I'm British and I once held a British passport, and where is it? And this is the effect, and it's affected my wife in this way, and, you know, we weren't able to go on holiday. That's not anything the CAB is going to be able to do. You need organisations who are going to sit with people, take what we call in the profession a witness statement, a detailed one. I've done a couple already and they've almost taken a day. And then I've had to say, right, now I need you to go off and get medical evidence, or I need you to do this, or I need you to do that. And what should really happen is people should have a choice as to how they do it. The government could set a budget. The numbers are tiny, you know. The numbers of people who are going to claim compensation are going to be quite small. And I think the government should say to people, legal aid would be a great way of dealing with this. But for instance, myself, I'm not a legal aid firm. So, you know, people should be, they should say, well, you know, even if it is the £500 that people can get back for past legal work, which is an issue, because some people went to immigration tribunals and spent thousands of pounds, and tribunals have got it wrong. I'm dealing with cases where they lost their case in the tribunal wrongly, and they've now been processed through the Windrush Task Force and have been given evidence of citizenship. But even if the government was to say, well, here's a budget, go off and find who you want to do this work, that's what should happen. And there's been a lack, I think, of engagement with those of us who work at the grassroots level. And it's almost because, you know, there's a mistrust of us. They think, well, we're just going to be out there to rubbish the scheme. And we're not. I mean, the reason why I've been working pro bono for years, because I really care about this. I could have charged people. Ironically, a lot of the Windrush people who come to me are homeowners and people who've had lengthy careers in the NHS. They can pay. a few hundred pounds for services, but I don't have the heart to take it. So this isn't about us profiteering. It's about making sure that our community is well treated and well respected. And just saying to them, we'll download a form and then go off to the CAB. And those who've already been to the CAB have just said, right, well, we'll tick, 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 tick. And well, you need to go and get this, that and the other. And we'll, it's not acceptable at all. And Martin's point about, you know, I don't want to be divisive between communities, but look at how, you know, this the publicity and the promotion for the European settled status. And I even understand, because in a previous world, I was actually CEO of an NGO dealing with foreign nationals in prisons on a secondment for 2 years. And I, so I know a lot of the organisations that work with migrants, and one of my colleagues who works with the Roma community actually said to me that they've actually been given a grant by government to work with them, because they're very concerned that the Roma community won't engage with this settled status, because you can't, they don't have addresses, they're all over the place, they're moving around. And yet nobody has said to the Caribbean community, of which, who are, as I said, the data shows that they are the ones disproportionately affected by the Windrush scandal. Nobody has said, well, here are some groups, here is some money. Nobody's ever going to make a profit out of it. Because even if they said, well, here's £500, you know you're going to really spend about £4,000 of your time on each case. And let the person go and get proper help so they make proper claims, because this is a full and final settlement scheme.
Yeah.
And at the moment, there's a group of us who are wondering whether we should say to people, and we're having a discussion about it next week, I'm caught in the middle of this discussion, don't apply. Let's go to court. Let's get this scheme judicially reviewed. And I don't want to do that. Because some people are destitute and they want to make their claims. But we've not been helping them to do that until we have this dialogue as to what is the best way to do this. And at the moment, we don't think that the current scheme is going to work well enough for some people. It will for some.
Yeah.
Can I just... I'll come back on that a little. I think... Jackie and I are in agreement, this is about implementation. I actually think the scheme, in terms of what it covers, is pretty comprehensive. The fact that it allows for inherited claims is something I don't think other schemes have done. And it's close family members, it's not spouses, it's, you know, it's more the extended family. And I think the fact that you have, theoretically at least, unlimited claims for impact on family life is quite a good thing, because the families wouldn't necessarily have a claim if they brought a claim in court. We've got a whole body of case law on things called secondary victims, and this scheme gets round that. So that, from that point of view, I would like it to be implemented as a fair to generous scheme. When I asked about the rollout and who would assist, the first problem that I encountered with big government was procurement rules. So they have certain rules about the governance and how you allocate grants, because obviously it's taxpayers' money. I've already asked, had a meeting on Friday, if they've got sort of tender type documents that the communities would know how to apply for government money. And I think there should be assistance around that most definitely. Like Jackie, I understand Citizens Advice hasn't always been the happiest experience for people around immigration issues. What I am told, and as I said, I remain to monitor it, is that interviews, face-to-face meetings will be bespoke, so people will not be queuing outside with everybody else with their housing problems. They'll actually be given a time slot. Now, it may well be there'll be a debate about how long that time slot needs to be, from what Jackie said about taking witness statements and getting the experience. But I'm also very concerned that whoever is helping is proactive. So if somebody comes in and says, I lost my earnings, my understanding is if they give a national insurance number, they say who their employer was, then the digging for the dates and the income should be done by those that are looking at compensation. They will say, we've done this research, you lost your job on this date, you had worked for the 2 or 3 years beforehand, that's our estimate of your loss of earnings, do you agree?
Yeah.
So there is a dialogue. So even after the claim's gone in, it has to be justified as to why you're allowing certain things and why you're not allowing certain things. Again, a lawyer might be best qualified to maximise a claim. I'm hoping, and I said I need to look at it, that those working for Citizens Advice in this area, if somebody says I've lost my earnings, they may say, and did you go to claim benefits? Yes, I did. How did you do that? Well, I had to get the bus every 2 weeks to show I was still looking for work. Well, let's include your bus fares. So they need to actually, did the loss of earnings have an impact upon your pension? Mm. And I need reassurance that the people that will be conducting these interviews will be trying to maximise claims. There's no doubt that a lawyer, that's our job, would try and maximise claims. Mm. I don't want people to feel that they're only getting the minimum, because they won't necessarily understand everything they should claim for. So if they say, I was very upset, I was depressed, you can have my GP records to show I was an antidepressant. And I know there's stigma attached to that, but again, and people may be very wary. The next question has to be, did that impact upon your relationship? Did it impact upon your relationship with your children? So I've had people say, yes, I became short-tempered. I couldn't sleep. Some people started drinking. Mm. These are quite sensitive areas. And I do understand that, and it may be explaining to a stranger that the true impact. I think our people are often very stoical and they don't like to make a fuss. And to maximise their claim, they're going to have to, in a sense, bare their souls, which brings its own trauma. So I'm very sympathetic to the idea that maybe having those discussions with somebody that you feel more of an engagement with than somebody maybe seen as an official at Citizens Advice will be difficult. And that's why I'm very keen that this idea of a rollout around community organisations gets going.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a good solution. The idea that people have gone to Citizens Advice in the past and have had bad experiences. I know a lot of our elders sort of don't forget things very quickly. And once you're sort of tarnished, they're kind of reluctant to sort of go back to that same person for help or that same organisation. So I think getting through to the communities and the churches is a great way forward.
Well, and the trust. I mean, I went to Luna House to see what they do there. And there was an elderly Jamaican lady who was getting her biometric card. And she was very upset because she'd had her fingerprints taken and she felt she was being criminalised. Yeah. And again, it's the lack of sensitivity. I asked about that and then I was told the legislation is that you have to get the card to get your naturalisation. And they said there'd need to be legislation change. Similarly around procurement, there's a tension between getting the scheme going, which has taken about 5 months since the end of the consultation period, but it's about a year in all. And waiting for procurement and governance, which I was told could take another 12 to 18 months. But the Home Secretary was anxious to start making payments. And again, the understanding of the scheme, there's a £500 legal fees cap, but it's for each application. It's not, so you can total those. But I did have a discussion as a result of a discussion I had with Jackie about those who'd had to go all the way through the tribunal process, which brings its own trauma, and where they've expended legal fees. And it seems to me they ought to be able to recoup those. And that's something that is under active consideration. So my personal view is that every time there's an issue, that rather than necessarily think, let's go running off to court, let's have a class action, go to the Home Office with it. There's a lot of goodwill towards the Windrush generation, and even if they're wavering on it, a story in the sympathetic press which says I actually suffered this loss and they're telling me I can't get it or it's limited, I think will prompt political pressure to modify the scheme. And I think that's how people have to work it, because I'm very keen that people maximise their claims and get everything that they are entitled to.
Yeah, can I just say that one thing to be clear about, though, is that I'm not having a real old knock at the Citizens Advisory, because I know that they help a lot of people in a lot of things. Yeah. And, you know, the origin of it is noble, but it's not suitable. It's not suitable for this in its entirety. There will be people who have absolutely no problems with it, but for the majority of people, there will be some issues, I think.
Yeah. Patrick, I mean, what's your thoughts?
That's funny. I used to be a manager of Citizens Advice Bureau many years ago. And CABs are very good at doing generic advice, information and signposting. And some CABs have specialist caseworkers that deal with debt advice. And actually, CABs are very good at doing debt advice. And yeah, some of them do immigration, but not a lot. So from my experience of being a manager of Citizens Advice, most average CAB, you have about 2-3 paid workers and most are volunteers. So if someone from the Rust generation is going to go to CAB, and they work with an experienced caseworker, that might be okay. But my concern, which I share with Jackie, is it's especially, you know, this process of unpacking your life story is traumatic. And my concern, particularly, I mean, I think Mark's done as much as he can in terms of getting the scheme off the ground, and we have to make sure it works. But I think one of the key principles missing from the scheme, which the government, from the very time that Theresa May apologised, and every single government minister has apologised, apart from the number 10 cat, Larry the cat, I don't think he's apologised, but he may have, I don't know. He might say, meow, I don't know. But the whole of government, it's unusual, as you know, for governments to apologise, especially to black people, so that's something. But one of the key essence of their apology, they kept them the same, was righting the wrongs. That is the litmus test that we have to adopt each time Jackie sees a client, each time that Martin sees someone from the Home Office. The question is, are we righting the wrongs?
Mm.
And for me, one of the key elements of righting the wrongs is about restorative justice. And the scheme itself is a scheme, it's fine on its own, but what's missing is the element of restorative justice. So the apology that the government's made has to be backed up with a restorative approach in terms of the principles, the values. So, like, for example, how are we going to engage with the women's generation so they can get access to the money? How can we listen to their stories so, as Martin said, that we get the maximum claim? These are kind of key principles, and that is part of the engagement design process. So one of the key things which the Home Office have not built into the scheme is not giving funding and support to grassroots organisations to support the government. We want to get the women's generation to have access to what they deserve. It's not an adversarial approach, but the government has created an adversarial approach by not acknowledging there's a whole social capital of faith groups, community organisations who want to assist. And a lot of them have been assisting and raised issues and doing surgery for the last 10 months. I think the very first surgery that took place was at Black Culture Archives, working with Jackie and other lawyers. That was the very first surgery that was done at the height of scandal. And since then, that's been a model at other, up in Leeds, Manchester, Birmingham, Nottingham, you name it, everywhere that I've been. And people have been doing it for the love of the community,
mm-hmm.
which is important. And the government has not really formally acknowledged that aspect of that. So that's one element. The second element is, one of the key impacts of the scandal has been on identity of black people and Caribbean people in Britain. And the scheme is not designed for that. It's designed for individual compensation. But there's something missing about that recognition that as a class of people, we've been denigrated our human rights. And that's not being factored in. I know that the government have given out grants for Windrush Day, but that's different. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about recognition that you've done a collective wrong as well as a collective individual wrong, and there needs to be a conversation somewhere. I think personally should be like do you remember when we reached the millennium and there were lots of money given out by government, like millennium grants, millennium, we should have a Windrush legacy fund of maybe $500 million set aside, for community work, restoring, if we're serious about this,
absolutely.
On top of the individual compensation claims.
Yeah,
because
I think I agree with what you're saying, Patrick. I think we have the Windrush scandal victims who have been directly affected. But then also as the wider British Caribbean community, we feel like, OK, another bad thing's happened to us. I feel like something needs to, like you said, be done to right the wrongs.
Yeah.
And maybe a sort of fund or something like that would help. Yeah.
It's not for let's organise grants for Windrush Day. That's one thing.
No.
I'm something much deeper, a deeper psyche.
Yeah.
We're talking about three generations of people being affected by the scandal.
Yeah.
You know, all the stuff that all the people I've met, grandparents, their parents, grandchildren, three generations have been affected on different levels. When you meet you talk to teenagers, say, well, if that happened to my grandparents, what about me?
Mm.
You know, it's a deep psychological. We haven't really unpacked this properly. I don't think we have, but I think that's one of the key things. If you compare what happened with the Holocaust, I mean, that's different. I'm not talking about reparations. That's another conversation. But if you look at modern day systematic discrimination of one set of people. There have been a whole process of building in recognition through history, through the national curriculum. So every single 14-year-old knows about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
But does every 14-year-old know about the Windrush?
The government's never going to do that unless we ask for it and demand it. And what we've got is a very weak community in terms of leadership, activism and organisation. The government knows that. So, for instance, Patrick mentioned, you know, the Black Cultural Archives. I've been running, or I was running, surgeries at the Black Cultural Archives, as I said earlier on, pro bono, from April almost to the beginning of August. You know, there were meant to be other lawyers coming, but most of them didn't turn up. And the Black Cultural Archives has been giving its space over to free. So essentially, it's working in partnership. The work that it's been doing is helping the Home Office. But the Home Office hasn't actually acknowledged that the work some of us has been doing has been to take the heat off them. We've stopped people from picketing. Mm. You know, I've been criticised. I've been called, Martin and I were called coconuts, weren't we, on Twitter, you know, because we've been trying to keep the heat off the government. There was going to be a picket of a meeting very recently, and I said, I don't think that's a very good idea. Mm. So we've taken a flat from the government, from our community, but we've also been recognised as being a bit suspicious by the government. And the reason why I mentioned the Black Cultural Archives, there's going to be a meeting next week, Tuesday, with the Home Office to discuss compensation. And the chair of the Black Cultural Archives is an elderly woman, stalwart of the community, has been invited, but she's currently got serious mobility issues. And she asked if she can get some help to get there. Transport, you know, it would be no more than £10 in an Uber each way from where she lives to where this meeting. And the Home Office just came back resoundingly no. Oh. And it shows to me that they've got, I really do not believe that they, she can pay her own fare, but this is a woman who's given up her centre for free for almost a year, has asked me to come back and do some more pro bono surgeries on compensation, and she'll give the space. And she's asking for, essentially, can you just send a car for me, because I'd really like to make that meeting. You should say yes if you cared about this community, because you would say yes to any other community. I'm sure of it.
Well, I'm horrified to hear that. I think there's a real disconnect, I'm afraid. This is one of the issues with the Home Office. It depends at what level you're dealing with people. So I suspect the person who's making a decision about taxi expenses has a guideline that they follow, and it's very much a kind of computer says no, and that destroys trust even more, destroys the ability to collaborate, because this should be, we should all want the same thing, which is fair and accessible compensation.
She did ask the head of the task force. She did go back, so it was somebody who sent out the invitations to the meeting. Obviously she's not going to be able to make the decision. She said, I'll need to go and check, and she's come back. I've seen the language that's been used. She said, I've gone and I've checked. And I know who she checked. I don't necessarily want to name people, but it is somebody extremely senior. She said, they said no. And does that mean you won't be coming then? Mm. Well, what kind of way is that to treat our community?
That's classic. That's what I'm trying to say. If we're talking about the principles of restorative justice, one of the principles were we want to create the space to engage and to acknowledge. And if they're not even saying that, then that tells you that no matter how well the compensation scheme is designed and implemented, people won't come to it if they feel that they don't feel valued and respected. So going back to the CAB days, a lot of Caribbean elders never used to get the full welfare benefits because they felt proud of not claiming. And it's going to happen again, but it's going to be the opposite. It's more about, I'm not claiming because people treat me in such a bad way. Why should I open my life story to someone to get a few thousand pounds?
I've had people say that already.
I understand that. I mean, it seems to me that in a funny sort of way that rather plays into government's hands if people aren't making claims.
Yes.
But I think this is an opportunity to just try and change the whole narrative. So you've got the scandal, you've got the compensation, you're talking about bigger pictures around respect and the role that my parents' generation played in this country. And that is a much bigger job. The narrative around immigration and migration in the press is still appalling. Although Windrush has, as I said, united right and left wing in a way that no other immigration issue has, in certainly in my experience. I think the national curriculum ought to include things about the Windrush generation. Yeah. I think a lot of people do not understand that my father's generation were invited here to rebuild this country after the war.
As British citizens.
My father did national service in the Air Force. Mm. So he was British enough in 1954 for them to say, you're doing 2 years, giving up 2 years of your life because Barbados is a colony to fight for Queen and country. And it's very insulting for that generation then to be told that they're not properly British or they've paid their tax and their national insurance. They've lived next door to a white British family. Their kids have gone to the same primary school, same secondary school, into employment. That the white British grandparents now have gone to Benidorm and can come back and forth as they please. Perhaps the Barbadian or Jamaican or Grenadian couple have emigrated, picked up their NHS pensions post 88, didn't realise that if you stayed out of the country for more than 2 years, you might struggle to come back in for family occasions. So that there are realistically two or three strands of citizenship in this country.
Absolutely.
There's been a gradual erosion of the rights of the Caribbean community through changes in the legislation over time. It's been made more and more difficult. There's a marked contrast between the treatment of those from the Black Commonwealth and the Antipodes, so New Zealand, Australia, South Africa have always had ancestral rights. They found it easy to get work permits. There's a huge debate to be had about equal treatment, and I suspect a lot of the legislation that's been was passed historically in the 70s and 80s would not be put on the statute books now because it's clearly discriminatory. And that's a big task. So I think what I'd be saying to the community is try and get some elected people in there on a manifesto commitment to make some fundamental changes.
Maybe the Windrush Party.
Immigration.
The Windrush Party. It's Patrick and I are going to set up, and Martin. Recruit Martin. Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, remember, the 1971 legislation came about mainly because of Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech. That's why it came about.
Well,
you know,
because Britain was going into Europe and thought we can't have migration from the Commonwealth and from the Black Commonwealth at the same time. And then, of course, you get all the narrative around people feeling swamped. And I mean, it's quite obvious to me why, certainly around employment issues, this has disproportionate effect to the Caribbean community. We look different. So when employers have effectively turned into border police and told you've got to make sure people have the right documents, they would look at all the black and brown faces in the room and they'd start with them. And of course, when they didn't come up with the right documents, that gave them an opportunity, I think sometimes quite cynically, to get rid of long-standing employees that they would have had to have paid a lot of redundancy to. They could say, you haven't got the documents, we don't have to pay you anything, the government's made us do it. So it was a very cheap option for them as well.
Well, I saw a real example of that enforced recently, actually. As you can tell, I'm not really a hairdresser person, but on the odd occasion I do go to one, they were telling me that they'd just been raided by immigration, and they're Ghanaians mainly, and some Caribbeans. And so immigration came in and decided to, you know, wanted to know the status of everybody in there, including some of the customers. So they all had to give their names, and they phoned through somewhere, and everybody checked out. You know, absolutely everybody. The owner had a British passport, they had indefinite leave to remain. The one person they didn't ask was Albanian, who had no status in the country. She was cowering in a corner, really scared, and they never asked her a single question. To me, that sums up what's going on. It's indicative of the hostile environment.
Well, I said before, it's about racial profiling, and I think one of the key issues around the racial profiling, even the way that the implementation of the consultation scheme, the scheme itself, is about racial profiling, because if it was based on principles of restorative justice, then people might feel, you know, there should be a stampede. Where is a stampede for the money? You know, like the Jerry Maguire film, Show Me the Money. No, seriously, or The Colour of Money. And the very fact that we need to put more pressure on the Home Office to fund community groups like a whole range of up and down the country and to do more priorities. We need to have those kind of surgeries, but funding and support. I mean, I've been working with JCWI, and we've got this Women's Justice Fund money. It's not a fantastic amount of money, but that, we're going to roll it out quite soon. But that's nothing. That's a drop in the ocean. We need, I mean, the very fact that you made, Martin, that the government have given a contract to the CAB, was it procured? Did they go for a tender process?
It wasn't.
So therefore, if they can do it with the CAB, they can surely do it with other organisations.
I mean, I think that what I was told was that they had an existing contract with them, and they could offer national coverage and, where necessary, translation services. And there was huge political pressure to get the scheme started.
No, I understand that.
Now, I'm not saying that I was turning cartwheels at that particular organisation being involved, but my role now is to see how it is implemented. And obviously, if there are things around implementation, if people have bad experiences there, I want to know.
No, I'm not trying to say that the CAB should, the contract should be taken away. I think we probably need to have that that approach. But it's about the government, the Home Office. They used to give out grants. It's not enough to still do, but they can give grants. They can say, right, let's work out. Let's look at the map of Britain. So in the southeast of England, London, which of the 2, 3, 4 community organisations working directly with the black community that we can give grants to do ABC? Let's look in the southeast, the northwest, the Midlands, southwest, and they could do that. And one of the key weaknesses is that the Home Office has not gotten a community engagement strategy. I mean, all of us have given advice and recommendations, but they're not taking it on board. And that's why we have to keep on putting pressure on them to have a proper strategy. The scheme is one part element of the strategy. The other element is communication and engagement, basically.
And it's the government. They can do what they like. I mean, they gave a contract to a ferry company that had no ferries, with no procurement at all. And that was worth millions.
Yeah, £50 million.
Yes. I mean, it's ridiculous, because what the community needs to do this job well is a tiny proportion of that.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, I'm hoping that there will be... I'm told there is going to be a tender process, and I hope people participate in it, and I hope they can show that they've got good governance and financial management, because that will be, again, something which I can see being put up as a barrier, and there's more suspicion about how the money's going to be used. I went and spoke to them the day that I think 57 organisations were given £9 million to help EC nationals, and I said, well, that's interesting. That process started in the November around tender, and the money was in place by February. And I wondered why we couldn't have run alongside the consultation a similar tender process for the community.
Yeah.
The response that I got was that the scheme has a number of elements to it, whereas the EC National scheme is basically, how long have you been here? What's your name? What's your connection with the country? So it was a simpler scheme. But it does show that where there is a will, there's a way.
So it goes back to that question that when you go to the Home Office next and you say to yourself, is this right in the wrongs?
No.
That's a question.
Absolutely, and it's not, because I do a lot of EU cases. Permanent residency was something that everybody was doing in a hurry up to Brexit, and now it's settled status. And it's less than an hour's work. Whereas, when you see somebody who's affected by the Windrush scandal, it's a couple of days' work. I mean, it's disproportionate, unfair treatment.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, I very much hope... I have communicated with them. I'm apparently also invited to the meeting on Tuesday, which is about engagement. And I think that this is the gap. So the scheme is there to make sure that it works fairly. You need to know that those who've got claims are able to speak to somebody who understands them and can maximise them. And if there is a deficiency around citizens' advice being able to do that, then I need to know about it. And I do understand, because I know the community, that they will be reticent about talking to a complete stranger about these very personal issues.
Yeah. And I think the tender process is probably a good one, but we know how these things work. Say to people, go and find somebody who you trust to do this, and this is the amount you can spend on it. Maximum amount, because in some cases it'd probably be quite straightforward.
Yeah, and I mean, before we decide to start wrapping up, I wanted to know, is there a deadline to when people can put these applications in for the compensation scheme, and not to leave it too late?
No, but there is a deadline, because the scheme is open for 2 years, so that will be until April 2021 at the moment. What I think, because I if there is a concern that claims aren't coming through, there will be a discretion, I'm sure, to extend that date. I feel, but not all of my advice is always followed, as you can imagine, that it probably ought to be 2 years from when the community groups are on stream. Mm-hmm. If you think there's going to be a spike then, if the people are waiting for the more trusted organisations. But there is a limit. The other thing is that my understanding is that Citizens Advice have not actually started the process of offering the interviews and the advice specific to Windrush. And we're a month on from launch, so I think there'd already now be an argument that the 2 years should run from when the advice is available and not before. So we've got this initial period where there will be teething problems. There will be huge complexities. And just to give you an example of one, a gentleman phoned me who was stopped from, he's a came here from Jamaica in 68, had a business where he went off to Ghana to advise on some construction work, tried to come back after 3 years via Dubai, was stopped in Dubai, sent back to Ghana, applied to the task force in November, having been battling with the Home Office from overseas for 3 or 4 years. You can imagine the cost and the expense and the phone calls, family members having to send him money, and has finally got back. And in the intervening period, his family have lost a rented property that they owned, and they got rental income, which was covering the mortgage on their family home, which was repossessed.
Oh my gosh.
And he said, I need a compensation lawyer. That is a complex claim.
Yeah.
And you know, it remains to be seen whether, however well-trained, somebody at Citizens Advice would be up to maximise. I mean, I'm struggling with the concepts, because you can imagine, yes, he would have kept the house, but if you give him his loss of earnings, he would have been paying the mortgage out of those earnings. But then, of course, the family have a claim for all the money they sent him to Ghana to support him as well. They'll have a claim for impact on family life. He's still not back at what he says. He's lost a business through this. That's not straightforward.
It's complex. It's very, very complex. This is not a download a form and go and see somebody at the CAB at all whatsoever. Just very quickly, because I know you're going to wrap up, and one of the things that I do want to also add in that's missing is that there are a whole number of people, because I've been doing Windrush cases for at least a decade, and there are a whole number of people who got into trouble, particularly after the 2014 legislation, the onset of what we call the hostile environment and what the government themselves call the hostile environment, who their way of dealing with it was to deal with it themselves. So they went and they naturalised, or they got something called a no time limit stamp. And I think that those people should get their money back as well.
Yeah.
And they're not in the scheme. And they're probably a larger number of people than the people who will be covered by the scheme. So I think this is an issue.
I think that's interesting. There will be people who the day before the task force, or the week or the month before, came into existence, because that's now offering the documentation for free, paid in the case of a biometric card, £1,300.
Yes.
Again, I've asked about how that figure was ever arrived at, and contrasted it unfavourably with the £65 that the EC nationals were being offered now free. And 3.7 million EC nationals at £65 is 240 million that was written off by making it free.
But that £1,300 is the fee for naturalising, but you can't naturalise on your own. They've got to go and do the Life in the UK test. Some of them have been put through really ridiculous courses to do that. The courses are £250. The Life in the UK test is £50. You've got to add that in. And then most lawyers, I mean, my firm charges £1,000 to do a naturalisation application. So, you know, people could have spent £3,000 to get a status that they already had.
Yeah. And I think that for me is where you might be looking at a class action, because they've all suffered the same loss for the same reason.
Yeah.
And there is a huge political argument about whether people should have had to pay for naturalisation at all. Because as I said, my dad, when he came in 53, thought moving from Barbados to Britain was the same as, you know, travelling from Southall to Ealing. He thought it was internal migration, and it was a huge shock to him in 73, when he then had to pay, I think it was about £80 in those days, to get citizenship.
And those rights were restored in 1981 under a registration scheme, but as some people have pointed out, people weren't said, you know, look, come and register. You know, they weren't, you know, somebody, Martin and I, were part of a round table, and an amazing lawyer, Francis Weber, said, you know, well, in the way you're reminded to pay your TV licence or your get an MOT for your car, why weren't people sent something? And so essentially, de facto, we say, well, these people were British. But yet they've all spent thousands and thousands of pounds acquiring a status they already had. A status that in law they might have lost in 1971 by that legislation, or 1973 by the 1971 legislation, but that was reinstated in 1981. I think there will be a class action around that. The government don't change.
I think it's the big issue. It's about rights and the wrongs, because when I did my petition a year ago, I used the word amnesty and automatic status on the basis that if we were British in the first place, why would we have to prove that we're British again? And so I think it should be backdated. So that includes maybe all our parents that applied for the nationalisation back in, I can remember that, 1981. I remember rushing and helping my parents complete the paperwork, because they thought they were going to lose their status. They had a choice. They had no choice. So I think it should be backdated from that time on back to 71, basically. If there's the same principles apply to EU nationals, that should apply. I was in Jamaica a few years ago, and I met with the head of the Royal Legion. And he said to me, we fought in the Second World War, but yet we have to come to Britain and apply for a visa. Whereas someone from Germany, from the old East, from Germany, they could walk in and out. And that shows the disparity and the contradictions that we fought as part of the Allies. We were part of the Hub, and yet we have to have visas to come to Britain.
Yeah.
And raise money in the Caribbean.
And raise, we raised £2 million back in the Second World War, probably equivalent to about £100 million now. Yeah. Still not, and again, that is not documented in historiography, history books, the national narrative of Britain. It's not there.
Yeah, no one knows. We don't know ourselves, do we? You know, it's got to right the wrongs.
Yeah. In closing, do you have any final thoughts or key points to take away from this discussion?
So I'm a sci-fi buff, and you know we see the opening credits of Star Wars, and it said the saga continues. That's what it did. The saga continues.
The saga does continue, but for me, I'm not so affected by the Home Office because I expect them to behave exactly the way they've behaved. I also expect the government to behave the way it's behaved. My concern is the community. And, you know, we use a phrase like black community, African Caribbean, whatever that means. But there is a group of people that are representative of people who look like me. And I think we've allowed this to happen because we've become voiceless. You know, we have no credible leaders. We have no voice or representation. We have no strong media. I mean, I know we're sitting in colourful radio studio here today, but I don't know how many people know of you. And I think we have a job to be done so that our community is treated in the same way that if this was an issue that was affecting the Muslim community, for instance, and I'm not comparing like with like, but, you know, Muslim Council of Great Britain would come out, the Board of Deputies, Jewish deputies would come out if it was affecting that community. Who comes out for us? Nobody. A few people making noise on the street with a few little bits of demonstrations and banging drums, and then they go away. We have one or two good speeches in the Houses, in a House of Parliament, rather, and then that stops. I mean, but there's been very few of those speeches. Some of our parliamentarians have said very little on this, which I've been really quite astonished by, really. Yep. Yeah. And I think the big thing is the work that I've been doing, one of the things that's been hampered by is a lack of resources. And so our community needs to get a grip. It needs to, I mean, it's great that we're sitting in this wonderful place that I was told earlier on by Kofi is self-financed and self-owned, because there's no resources. You know, there's been absolutely, The Guardian did an appeal for funding, raised over £1 million in the name of Windrush, and it went to organisations who do great work, but none of it directly with the people who are affected by Windrush. And we've really got to build our own resources and build some movements and some organisations so that we start getting taken seriously in this country.
Absolutely.
And I echo that, and I hope that's the true legacy from the Home Office perspective, knowing that there's a central, credible organisation that speaks for the community is a real difficulty. I think far too many of the island-based organisations are around a cult of personality, and they're very exclusive to the island. The Caribbean community as a whole need to have an organisation. Somebody says we need possibly the equivalent of an NAACP in this country, so that government know they can go to that organisation. They speak for the community, and I think it really surprised me that I didn't know what was going on in immigration. I'm not an immigration lawyer, but I didn't know about foreign national offenders. I didn't know about the deportations. I walked around my chambers and explained that people who came here as children are being deported in their 30s to an island they don't remember, even when they've got children in this country, and nobody supported that. But somehow it's on the statute books. Somebody thinks they have a mandate for it. And, you know, that slightly sleepy approach to immigration issues can never happen again. So, you know, we need an organisation, and we need a network whereby as soon as anybody is threatened with deportation, that organisation or that group of organisations know, and they also know who the go-to lawyers are, who the go-to politicians are going to lobby. They need a friendly media as well. And I'm hoping that one of the legacies will be the fact that I have met Patrick and Jacqueline going forward, and, you know, that you can form those networks and know that you've got, you know, that the community have some genuine support. They don't have to rely upon big government or handouts. They have got professional people that will speak for them and represent them effectively.
Absolutely. I want to thank you both for coming in this morning and joining me and Patrick on the Voices of Windrush. You've provided so much insight, useful information, and I hope that the community feel reassured by what you and Jacqueline have said this morning. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for the opportunity, because yes. I have struggled to get the conventional media to give me an opportunity to explain how things really work.
Yeah.
Yes, no, thank you very much. It's really important that we continue to talk to our community. We'll certainly be spreading the word that you exist and getting more people to tune in, because generally it is very difficult to get our voices heard, really.
Yeah.
But thank you.
Yeah. Patrick, anything?
And the saga continues.
The saga continues.
Got a starship waiting outside. Yes. It's my car, it's so old.
Thank you, Patrick. That was the Voices of Windrush with me, Sinai Flary, my co-host, Mr. Patrick Vernon, Martin Ford QC, and Jacqueline McKenzie. Thank you so much for listening. This has been the Voices of Windrush on Colourful Radio.